attacker from the University of California at Berkeley, and I can use him as one of the living pythons of this field, experimental superfluidity. Don't want to flatter him, but this is a difficult technique, and I think he's really mastered it and taken it to different levels over the years, following the traditions of people, I would say, going way back to Carmelo Nonis and eventually to, you know, Capitan. So, bring out the earth a little bit. A little bio on Professor Packard. He was a native of Rochester, New York, not far from here. And there he spent many winters, we found out last night, playing hockey. And every once in a while, coming up north of the border to buy firewood. And anyway, he did an undergraduate at SUNY Buffalo. From there, he went out to Vermont to do a master's. And then he did his PhD at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Cold climate places. I guess a good apropos to low temperature physics. And he finished his PhD in 3 years, record times. And after that, he went to Berkeley, the sunnier side, or the warmer side of the US. And he's been there ever since with a very distinguished career. Most recently, he was honored with the Distinguished London Experimental Research Prize. And he's been, this is for the work he's been done, all the cutting edge work he's been done on experimental superfluidity. I think the most recent achievement is the observation of Josephson effect in superfluidity, in superfluids. And one little thing I can say about him is that he's an avid sailor. I mean, he literally sails and has actually built a boat on his own before he was a PhD student. So the things that you learn beforehand actually helps you do research and afterwards. And I look at his webpage, it's actually an entire CV of where he sailed. Anyway, I know him as a professor of mine when I was at Berkeley, and it was really in his class where when I saw pictures of vortices that he actually took his lab and woke me up to this whole, you know, field of superfluidity, you know, the so-called macroscopic quantum effects. And arguably, this is probably the most macroscopic quantum phenomenon. So I guess it's a pleasure to have him here today, an honor, and he's going to give us further explorations and discoveries he made recently in the subject. So let's welcome Professor.
That was such a nice introduction. I think John should just give the talk. I think of the things he said, the one that I was most proud of, if I could have stimulated somebody to become a physicist, that would please me more than the other things. My son, who just graduated from college and thinks most college professors are really quite stupid, said he thinks it's much more important to be a decent teacher than to be a decent researcher. I'm very happy to be here. As John said, I grew up fairly near here. Actually, I was born in Rochester, but I grew up in Buffalo. And I did come up to Canada to buy fireworks because you couldn't get it in New York. But there was a second reason that I didn't mention. There was a rather promiscuous girl up here who used to entertain my friends and I. So that was well, she had a good sense of humor, and that was more important than the fireworks. Well, what I'm going to tell you about today is some work that I've been involved in for about the last decade, and I'm not going to be able to tell you all about it. What I hope to do is give you the flavor of what we did and make you interested enough so that maybe you'll go and read some of our papers. Anything you want to know about this stuff, all the papers are on my website, and if you just Google the words Packard Group, you'll get to the site, and then you'll see the papers. And there's also a couple of review articles in the Reviews of Scientific American. So I don't expect you to understand everything, not because it's difficult, but because I'm going to cover a lot of stuff. So first, I should just list the people who have worked with me on this. I'm going to talk about two topics. You may know that there are two types of superfluids. Helium-4, which is a bosonic system, and helium-3, which is a BCS system. They are quite different in their microscopic properties, but quite similar in their generic properties. In fact, superfluids are just one of an example of so-called macroscopic quantum systems. When I was a graduate student, there was only helium-4 and superconductors. But now there's more than the fingers on one hand. You've got a collection of Bose-Einstein condensates, a collection of BCS things, high TC materials, interiors of neutron stars, some people say exciton droplets. All these things have generic properties in common, and some of those properties are the things called Josephson effects, and those are the things I'll address today. I'm going to start the talk by describing our work on helium-3, and this group of people worked with me, And then I'm going to end up by telling you what we've been doing for the last 18 months. Emil Hoskinson is the lead student on here, and he's a Canadian, originally from Toronto and then from Vancouver. And I was saying, you and the faculty should keep an eye on Emil because he's just going now to take a postdoc, but he'll be done in 2 years, and he's a real star. So these are some of the topics that I'll talk about. I've got to tell you what a superfluid weak link is, talk about the Josephson equations. Then I'm going to talk about helium-3, and I'll talk about three topics: Josephson oscillations, how we deduce something called the current phase relation, and then the title of the talk said physics and applications, and the application I'm going to talk about we call a superfluid gyroscope. It's a device which potentially could be the most sensitive detector of rotation. Now, you might wonder, why would one want such a thing? That's so esoteric. There aren't lots of uses for such a device. There's a class of scientists referred to as geodesists who monitor small changes in the Earth rotation using an array of radio telescopes displayed around the globe. It's possible superfluid gyroscopes could replace or complement that technology. It could be used for a test of general relativity. It could also be used for inertial navigation in submarines. You probably know submarines can't make use of the global positioning system because radio waves don't propagate in salt water. Then I'm going to turn to helium-4 and talk about more Josephson effects and talk about a possible practical gyroscope. The device up here may not be practical because helium-3 superfluidity, you should know, only occurs below about 1 millidegree. So I can't imagine that any submarine navigator is going to have a nuclear demagnetization cryostat with a sample of helium-3 a million times colder than room temperature. But it's possible in helium-4 that one will be able to make a turnkey device where you don't have to use any liquid helium. So let me get on with it. So first let me tell you generically what a weak link is. The picture at the top is sort of the way you should visualize the system. Imagine that the two samples, the light blue one and the dark blue one, are two different samples of superconductor, superfluid, Bose-Einstein condensates, neutron star stuff. It doesn't matter. The significant thing is that both samples are described by a wave function, a so-called macroscopic wave function. And all the physics I'm going to talk about is going to come out of the phase of that wave function. Not much is going to come out of the magnitude of it. So I use the symbol L's to stand for left and R to stand for right. The particles on the left each have an energy mu L. I use the energy per particle being chemical potential in a condensed matter system, but think of it as just the energy of the particles. And the material on the right has all the particles each has an energy mu R. By a weak link, we mean a way of coupling together these systems so that it's not one uniform system. You want the wave function to begin to fall off, but yet penetrate the other side. So this yellow line is the magnitude of the wave function. It falls off with some characteristic length, but penetrates the other side. Similarly for the one on the left-hand side. This characteristic length, by the way, is going to be an important length in this problem. It's called the healing length. It's the I think that's a descriptive way of saying it. It's the length over which the wave function can bend. The reason wave functions can't bend suddenly is, you remember, there's a second derivative term, a curvature term, in the Schrodinger equation. So wave functions never go thunk like that. There's a balance in energies that determine what scale length they cross over for. If you write down a pair of coupled Schrodinger equations for those two wave functions. And this is done, by the way, in Feynman Volume 3. He has a chapter 22 on superconductivity, and he sets up the problem this way. If you write down the Schrodinger equation with a coupling term between the two systems and then turn the crank, pluck in these two wave functions and turn the crank, you're going to get a real equation and an imaginary equation from the real and imaginary part. And what comes out are the following two equations. Let me use the symbol delta phi to be the phase difference between the left and the right. This is going to be the important quantity, phase difference. What you find is this. If a particle current goes from one side to the other, let's call it a current I, the phase difference between the two sides adjusts, and it adjusts in such a way that the current is proportional to the sine of that phase difference. This constant in front, sometimes called the critical current, that's going to depend on just what the coupling was, whether it was superconductor or superfluid or so on. And I won't be concerned with that number. The second equation comes out, is that the time rate of change of the phase difference is proportional to the difference in the energy of the particles on the left and right divided by Planck's constant. This equation has a lot of different names for it. Some people call it the A.C. Josephson equation. I don't know why. There's nothing A.C. about it. Brian Josephson was the first person to write it down, I think. However, it's really Newton's law. It's just F equals ma disguised in a quantum mechanical version. We call it the Josephson-Anderson phase evolution equation because it tells how the phase evolves in time. So these two equations, all the physics I'm going to talk about comes out of these two things. And when these two equations are applied to superconductors, as it was during the late 60s and the 70s and the early 80s, there was probably 20,000 papers written on this topic in superconductors, all coming out of just those two equations. But I want to show you what I think is sort of the most dramatic effect that comes out of these. Imagine that you have delta mu being a constant. So suppose you raise all the particles on the left side by some energy compared to the particles on the right side. If it was a superconductor, you could do that by connecting a battery across it. If it was a superfluid, you could have a higher pressure on one side than the other side. If this was a classical system, what would happen? Let's say these were two metals, and you connect a battery from the left to the right. What would happen? A DC current flows, right? If it was a fluid, and you make this side at a higher pressure than this side, what happens? The liquid flows from one side to the other. Look what these two equations say. Let delta mu be a constant and integrate this equation. It would say that delta phi is a constant times the time. And then if you put that into here, it would say the current would go as a sine of the constant times this time, sine omega t. That's an oscillation. So for this quantum mechanical coupling, it says if you push the particles through that coupling, whatever it is, instead of going through, they start to go through, and then they come back at you. And then they go through again, and then they come back at you. And if you push harder to get them through, meaning you make delta mu greater, it just oscillates faster, but nothing goes through the hole. That's the characteristic thing that you see in all two-level systems in quantum mechanics. You get oscillations between the two states. And much of the physics I'm going to talk about is of that nature. So I put those two equations down here, and I wrote, again, that the current goes as the sine of the chemical potential difference times the time. This frequency is called the Josephson frequency. The frequency depends on what the nature of the chemical potential difference is. For a superconductor, if you connect a battery, V, between the two sides, delta mu is 2eV. Chemical potential for a neutral fluid is the mass of the atom and then times the quantity in parenthesis, where delta P is the pressure, rho is the total density, S is the entropy per unit mass, and delta T is the temperature. So one fundamental prediction, and this is important, is how do you know when you have a weak link? Well, the answer is if I try and push stuff from one side to the other, it won't go through. It'll start to oscillate. There's a big difference between superconductors and superfluids on different in a numerical aspect. This Josephson frequency for superconductors is a huge number, 483 terahertz per volt. That's such a high frequency that nobody's ever seen in real time a Josephson frequency. Nobody doubts they exist because you can detect them indirectly by microwave mixing and things like that, but you can't see it in real time. One way of making a weak link, by the way, with superconductors, you can do it in many ways. Josephson's original thing was a tunneling barrier, but I'm going to be talking about what's sometimes called a Dayan bridge. You have the superconductors or the macroscopic quantum states connected together by a link whose dimensions are this thing I call the coherence length. Right? So you want to pinch it down between the two samples so that that wave function bending, you sort of squeeze the wave function in there. That's how you do the weak coupling. The analog of that in a superfluid would be to have two samples separated by a thin wall with a little hole in it. And you make the thickness of the wall and the diameter of the hole comparable to that healing length. The number for the Josephson frequency is very different between the superfluid case and the Josephson one. For helium-3, their chemical potential really doesn't have a temperature term because the entropy is too small because you're at 1 millidegree. This number is written as 183 hertz per millipascal. Millipascals are the pressure range that you can easily put on these fluids. So instead of being terahertz, it's kilohertz. For helium-4, the number comes out 68 hertz per millipascal. The difference between helium-3 and helium-4, besides a factor of 2,000 in temperature, I told you that helium-3 becomes a superfluid below 1 millikelvin. Helium-4 becomes a superfluid below 2 Kelvin. So it's a huge difference in temperature. But another important difference is the size of this healing length. For helium-4, it's only about 1 angstrom. So you'd have to have a hole 1 angstrom big in a wall 1 angstrom thick and then detect the mass current coming through that. That's not going to happen. Helium-3, on the other hand, the healing length is much bigger. It's like 70 nanometers. And you can make walls and holes that size. Both of these numbers are temperature dependent. You can make the lengths bigger by approaching the transition temperature, and you'll see where that plays an important role in a little while. Those are the two expressions. I'll come back to them for the temperature dependence. They both scale as 1 over the ratio of the temperature to the transition temperature with different exponents in here. So first I'm going to talk about helium-3 to exploit this longer thing. All the Josephson effects that we first saw were in helium-3. Although it was 2,000 times colder, the holes are hundreds of times bigger, so that's technically easier to make. Now, I've got to describe to you the kind of apparatus that we make. Yes, sir?
Do you have an intuitive explanation for the difference between
them? No, I have a hand-waving explanation.
Yeah.
So the physics behind them is completely different. It's completely different. For the helium-3 case, that's a Cooper-paired system, and that length is the size of a Cooper pair. For helium-3, there is no Cooper pair, and it's basically the interatomic spacing. But that's not a very good answer, to tell you the truth.
Helium-4,
I'm sorry. So let me describe the kind of apparatus that we use, because you won't be familiar with this. In electronic systems, what do you measure? You measure currents and voltages. We want to do the analogous thing. So voltage differences are energy differences or chemical potential differences. For the neutral matter case, you want to measure pressure differences. That plays the analog of voltage. Instead of electric current, we want to measure mass current. So how do we do that? This is the kind of cell that we make. This light blue stuff is the helium-3. It's not really light blue. It looks like the color of gin. It's clear. We have a small cylindrical cell. This is maybe a centimeter across and a fraction of a millimeter high. And it's bounded, at least on one side, by a flexible plastic membrane. And we put on the other side a silicon chip that has in it etched a thin window of silicon nitride about 40 to 50 nanometers thick. Silicon nitride is really tough material. Then in that hole, we etch an array of little apertures. Here's one of the apertures, and it's about 60 nanometers across. Why am I using an array? By the way, it's a 65 by 65 array, so you should be thinking about some 4,000 holes spaced about 3 microns apart. Each hole is 60 nanometers. Why do we use an array? We use an array because for 10 years I did experiments on single apertures, and I saw nothing of interest, absolutely nothing of interest. So my thought was, maybe there was interesting Josephson physics in there, but it was too small to be seen. And I thought, we've run out of tricks. If you use an array of apertures, maybe by some miracle, all 4,000 apertures will be quantum mechanically coherent with each other, and whatever one of them does, 4,000 will do, and everything will be amplified by 4,000. When I put that in a research proposal to the National Science Foundation, 3 out of the 6 referees came back and said, there's no reason they should be quantum mechanically coherent. As you'll see, they are quantum mechanically coherent, and now everybody says, oh, it's obvious they should be quantum mechanically coherent, which is why refereeing is kept confidential, because you can say a lot of stupid things, and nobody will make you responsible for it. So the way this works, the way we were going to detect pressure differences and currents, is by making use of this flexible diaphragm. You can think of the fluid as being incompressible. If fluid flows in through this hole at the bottom, or this array of holes, it will move the diaphragm. Does that make sense? You're like blowing up a little balloon. And if you monitor the motion of the diaphragm, its displacement, x, as a function of time, that tells you the mass current going through the little holes. Does that make sense? Now, how are you going to measure the displacement? These are very tiny currents. So we make use of the technology that was developed for gravity wave detectors. The old Weber bar gravity detectors, the idea was you have a couple of thousand pounds of aluminum bar, and a gravity wave goes through it and taps it like a little bell, and you want to listen to it ring. So you make a very sensitive microphone. And the way the microphone works is as follows. The diaphragm is coated with superconducting film, and that rests in front of this blue thing, which is a pancake coil, a coil wrapped like this, of superconducting wire that has an electric current trapped in it, and the leads on that coil go up to a superconducting squid device. And the idea is if you move the superconducting film with respect to the coil, you change its electrical inductance. And when you do that, some of that trapped current goes into the squid, and it's registered as a signal. This is remarkably sensitive. You can detect a displacement of one nuclear diameter. That's amazing. 100,000 times smaller than an atom. Without that technology, none of this would happen. The pressure difference in here is determined by the flexure of the diaphragm. The current goes as dx dt, the motion. But the bulging of it is determined by the pressure difference. So by measuring x of t, we get both numbers that you need. Dx dt is the current, if you know the ratio of the areas, and x itself is the pressure if you've calibrated that as a pressure gauge. So everything I'm going to talk about is going to come out of cells using that kind of technology. So first, imagine this in some kind of refrigerator that cools the helium-3 down to below 1 millikelvin. I'm not going to talk about the cooling technique. And the first experiment I'm going to describe is what happens if you suddenly pull up on this diaphragm. The way you pull up on it is this green thing is a metal plate. Typically something like copper or gold. And if you connect a battery between the green plate and the metal film, you pull up on it electrically, electrostatically. So we'll pull up on it. That'll make the pressure inside smaller than the outside. And according to those two coupled Josephson equations, instead of the fluid flowing in, what should it do? It should oscillate. Well, when we first did this experiment, this was sort of the last trick we had up our sleeves. When you looked at the motion of this diaphragm on the face of an oscilloscope, it just looked like noise. Didn't look like there was anything of interest there. But an old friend of mine from UCLA who had been an acoustician told me many years ago, when you see electrical signals that don't make sense on an oscilloscope, take that signal and listen to it in a set of headphones. Because sometimes your brain can do an analysis that your eye can't see. And I told that to my graduate students, and what did they think? He's out of his mind, right? There's no signal here. Now, I kept saying, use headphones. And they knew there was nothing there. And Berkeley gets some very good graduate students and postdocs, and they came up with a very good theoretical idea, reason why this could not work. The reason was, we don't have any headphones. Sad to say, that's a true story. So I went out with my own hard-earned money down to Radio Shack, brought home headphones, laid them on the table. They went into huddle and came up with a much deeper theoretical model. They said, I mean, these guys know string theory and all the rest. They said, the connector's wrong. Well, I love to tell that story when they're not in the audience. To make a long story short, I went and got a connector and sort of hurled it at them and said, now put them on and listen. And the first time, our postdoc, Sergei Pereverzev, did that. He switched a battery from here to here, and I'm going to play for you the sound that he heard. Now, what you're going to hear is a lot of background sounds, because this diaphragm is the world's most sensitive microphone. So you hear sounds from the building and boiling and stuff like that. But then your ear is going to hear an oscillation back in there, I hope. Let's see. Could hear that? Do it again. Well, believe me, your eye can't see that on an oscilloscope. And the reason it can't see it, I hadn't realized that frequency should be drifting in time. We're looking for just a sine function. But it's a sine function buried in noise, which is drifting in time. But once your ear hears it, you know it's in there, right? So then you go in and you take the data, which has been digitized, and you Fourier transform little pieces of it. And for each piece of time, you look at the flexure of the diaphragm and you read off the pressure and you get the frequency that corresponds to that pressure. And then you do that by breaking up the whole thing in little pieces of time. What the Josephson equation predicts is that that frequency was 183 hertz per millipascal. So when we made the graph, it looks like that. That's the frequency. That's the pressure. The line drawn through the points is the Josephson frequency relationship. These are data taken at a whole bunch of different temperatures. They all lie on the same line because there's nothing temperature dependent in the formula. It's just the mass of the helium atom, Planck's constant, and the density of the material. What this did for us was say, hey, these things are quantum mechanically coherent. We could, from the magnitude of that whistling sound, we call it a quantum whistle, from the magnitude of it and the expected magnitude of the critical current, we could tell that all 4,000 apertures are all going together. And I could tell you why I think that's true, but it doesn't matter what I think. The fact is that they are quantum mechanically coherent. And this told us we had basically an array with a big critical current that was acting like an ideal Josephson weak link. So then we went off to do some physics. The first thing we wanted to measure was the current phase relation of the system. By current phase relation, when I drew the equation that said the current I is proportional to the sine of delta phi, that's what I mean by a current phase relation. That's the so-called Josephson limit when you get a sine function in there. But that healing length was temperature dependent. You should get a Josephson-like current phase relation when the temperature is high enough that that healing length is getting comparable to the size of those apertures. But when you go colder, that length is going to get shorter and shorter with respect to the hole, and the hole should become a strong link. It shouldn't be Josephson-like anymore. So the question was, how will that relationship between current and phase change with temperature? Well, the way we determined that, I thought was a very clever way. My student Scott Backhaus thought this up. It works as follows. The only parameter that we measure in this, besides temperature, is that position of the diaphragm, x of t, and everything's going to come out of that. So first of all, the current is proportional to dx dt, the velocity of that diaphragm. A is the area of the diaphragm and rho is the density. So by measuring dx dt, you get the current. We want to get current phase. How are you going to get the current phase? Well, the Josephson Anderson phase evolution equation says d phi dt is given by this expression. Delta p is some calibration constant times x, the deflection of the diaphragm. Hearing the Josephson frequency let us get an absolute calibration on this number. Because all the points laid on the straight line, we assume the Josephson formula is correct, and we have an in situ sort of National Bureau of Standards calibration. That is, 1 millipascal is that deflection that corresponds to 183 hertz. So you know this in absolute terms. So you can integrate the phase evolution equation. You get phi as a function of time is the integral of x of t with those constants in front. If you've got phi as a function of time and current as a function of time, you eliminate the time and you get I of phi. Follow that? So that's the basic technique. So when we did that, the x of t curves we're looking at are things that are like this. These are the signatures that result when you put on a pressure step. So you suddenly pull the diaphragm to one side. I won't go into this, but the equations of motion of the system are exactly the same as those of a rigid pendulum. The rigid pendulum has three modes. You usually only think of two of them, but when you first learn about the rigid pendulum, the limit of small angles, it's a simple pendulum, right? When you make big amplitudes, it's nonlinear, and it sort of stops up at the top, right? That's when the sine of phi is not equal to phi. When you give it a lot of energy, the rigid pendulum swings around on its pivot point, like that. Well, when we give it a big kick, the swinging around is that Josephson oscillation. That's this fast oscillation here. And the frequency is going down, just as you heard it on that audio clip, as the pressure drops. That corresponds to this having a little damping in the system. This goes slower and slower and slower. Finally, it's caught at the top, and it goes like this in that mode, and then finally goes down into the simple pendulum mode. So we take one of these transients. By the way, this slowing down here, that's the pendulum kind of slowing down at the top like that, and then it finally flops down. So we take these transients. This is x as a function of time. We take the time derivative and the integral, and from it get the current phase relationship. What comes out were two discoveries. You know, when you're experimentalist, you tend to start out trying to prove something that a theory predicted. But if the truth be told, if you've proved the theory, you only learned a sociological fact, which was that the theorist was right. You didn't learn any new physics. What you want to know is if you can prove that the theory's wrong, you got two things. You proved the sociological fact about the theorist. But more importantly, you learn what the right answer was. So what you like to do is discover new things. So we discovered two new things out of here. First of all, there's two sets of curves. It turned out that the helium-3 weak links had two different metastable states. One was stable and one was metastable. We called them the high critical current state and low critical current state. That's what the H and L stood for. That was not a predicted phenomenon. Now there's microscopic theory that, quote, predicts it. I don't quite understand that, actually, how you can predict something when you already know the answer. But I'm told that's a prediction. In any event, this is supposed to be now understood microscopically. I have no idea if it really is or not. It's sort of like, you know, when you take a physics exam, if the professor is stupid enough to give you a question and say, show that, you know, such and such equals such and such, we're all going to have that at the end of the thing. And then the poor professor has to struggle to see if, you know, you made any mistakes. Well, we can't do that with theory papers, right, because they're too complicated. I'm making a lot of friends here with theorists. Sorry, there, Ellen. So this is what comes out of it. These are sets of curves at different temperatures. So the orange and red, the temperature is dropping as you go from these terms, these curves down here, to these curves up here. It starts out like a sine function. That's what the Josephson weak link regime is. The healing length then is large or comparable to the size of the apertures. And that's what you expect to happen. What we didn't expect to happen was it begins to morph into something that has an extra bump in it. It starts changing from being 2 pi periodic to being pi periodic. And that turns out to give out some interesting dynamics. Before we understood these curves, we discovered something called a pi state, where the system would stably get hung up with pi phase difference across it. And there was a number of theory papers trying to explain that, but now we can understand them all in terms of these current phase relations. So I just throw these up here to show you that one can determine these, and I won't talk much about them. I want to move on, since I'm talking about applications. I'm going to have to move here. To the device that we call a superfluid gyroscope. If you're at all familiar with superconducting squids, you'll recognize this. If you're not familiar with it, I'll explain how it works. But again, Feynman Volume 3, Chapter 22. We all recite chapter and verse these days. He describes the thing. It's very important with George Bush as president to recite chapter and verse, right? You've all heard of Matthew 4:16. This is Richard 3:22. I just thought that up. That's a pretty good line. So the way this works is as follows. It's a macroscopic quantum interferometer. There's a little toroidal container with a weak link in either side. By weak link, I mean one of our arrays. And you inject current from the top, and it splits on the two sides and recombines at the bottom and comes out. When you analyze this system and imagine that this thing is rotating with angular velocity omega, the prediction is twofold. One is the combination here behaves just like a single weak link. That is, it should have that quantum whistle. It should have the same current phase relation. It should act just like one weak link. That's a pretty nifty result. The one difference between this and one weak link is the number that plays the role of this critical current will depend on how it's rotating. And it depends in this cosinusoidal fashion. This thing I called IC star, which should be the critical current, which you can interpret to be, let's say, the loudness of that whistle, will depend cosinusoidally on the rotation flux, omega dot A, threading this loop. So imagine that omega is the rotation vector and A is the canonical area vector. You basically induce phase shifts between helium going on one side and helium going on the other. It's kind of like a Berry's phase shift, or you see this in a lot of quantum mechanical systems. So the prediction is, if you make this device, it'll whistle just like one, but if you listen to the loudness of the whistle and vary omega or A, you can't vary H or M3. In fact, it's pretty hard to vary A. You should see this critical current be modulated cosinusoidally. Well, we wanted to demonstrate that you could use this to monitor the rotation of the Earth. The point was to show that this could be used for geodesy, that it was detecting absolute rotation. So not only could we not vary H or M or A, we couldn't vary the rotation of the Earth either. But we could vary that dot. That's the easy thing, right? Omega dot A means you've got a cosine in there of the angle between the area vector of this loop and the rotation vector of the Earth. So we made a device, which is shown, I think, in the next slide. This was made by Ray Simmons. This is about 3.5 inches tall. This is the pickup loop, and there's two weak links in either side here. I won't go into the rest of this. We take this device, and I had a refrigerator in my lab from some other experiments that was made to rotate. So we set this thing up, and we slowly reorient it with respect to the north-south axis of the Earth. And that's varying the flux of the Earth through it. It turned out this thing did whistle, just like a single weak link. And as we recorded the whistle amplitude as a function of the orientation angle, it did show that cosinusoidal modulation. That's it right there. This is the magnitude of that whistle as a function of the rotation flux through it. Kappa 3 stands for H over 2m3. It's called the quantum of circulation. So this demonstrated sort of a proof of principle experiment on how you could use this as a sensitive gyroscope. Now, the next step is kind of interesting historically. Everybody who worked on this project left, and I took on a new student, this gentleman, Emil Hoskinson. And Emil's job was to make the next helium-3 gyroscope. Well, it's very expensive and time-consuming to do these helium-3 experiments. It takes months to prepare a run, and then once you run for months. It's costing over $100 U.S. per day for liquid helium. Also, the graduate student salaries, they're very well paid in the United States. So what we like to do is build something and test it in helium-4 first. We can test this pressure gauge, is the superconductors working, is the squid working, all that. So Emil made a little cell to test some new arrays, and he was going to test them in helium-4 before he put them into helium-3. And then the whole story changes. I'll interject this. We did many, many experiments with helium-3 weak links. This is sort of a master slide showing a lot of things, and I don't have time to talk about these, but these are described in a review article in Reviews of Modern Physics from a few years ago. Let me talk about helium-4. This is the graph of that healing length, that some people call it a coherence length. At a temperature of about 2 millidegrees, that healing length should be comparable to the diameter of our holes. This is the actual formula for that coherence length. At low temperatures, this coherence length is on the order of a few angstroms, much, much, much smaller than our 50 or 60 nanometer holes. But if you get at temperatures quite near the lambda point is the name given for the transition temperature from superfluid to normal, you can get into the regime where this length is comparable to the size of our apertures. Who knows whether it should be like the diameter or the radius? It doesn't matter. What Emil did is take his cell. He was testing it to see if it all worked, but he let the temperature drift up slowly. And I'll show you what happened when he got near the lambda point. But first, let me tell you how a helium-4 strong link should work. We studied this phenomena for many years. Philip Anderson once asked the question, how can a superfluid that has no viscosity lose energy? Viscosity is the mechanism that normally loses energy in a fluid. And he came up with the idea of phase slippage via quantized vortices. Richard Feynman had thought up the idea of quantum vortices in the middle 50s. Anderson was well aware of that work. And his idea was like this. Imagine that superfluid is passing through a hole. Suppose you have a chemical potential difference between the sides. That's just a fancy way of saying, imagine you're pushing the helium from one side to the other. The helium will accelerate because there's no friction. It'll go faster and faster. But then he said, at some speed, let's call it a critical velocity, you'll nucleate near some edge a quantum vortex. And he then showed that no matter how the vortex moved, if it crossed the whole hole, it would remove 2 pi worth of phase difference between the two sides. And since phase difference corresponds to velocity, you will have decreased the velocity by a certain amount, and therefore you will have dissipated some energy. The specifics are you drive the fluid with a chemical potential difference. When the superfluid velocity Vs gets to this critical velocity, you nucleate a vortex, it passes across the aperture, and you remove amount of velocity, I'll call it V slip, and that turns out to be Planck's constant over the mass of the atom divided by some kind of effective length, where the effective length is basically a combination of the diameter and the real length of the hole. That's called a 2 pi phase slip because it corresponds to a 2 pi phase difference. So, in fact, this phenomenon had been studied for ever since the middle 1980s. A group in France, Eric Veriquo and Olivier Avenel, did beautiful experiments where they could see single phase slips in helium-4. This is sort of, you might wonder, how does the vortex actually move across? It's very non-intuitive. If this is the aperture, this is what's believed to happen. Numerical simulations give you this. If you start out and stick in a little vortex of some small size right near the edge, and follow the contact point on the surface, it first moves away, growing, and then it turns around and goes back over the hole. So it sort of goes whoop, and then gets bigger and passes by. So it doesn't matter really what happens topologically, it makes the system slip with this much energy. Suppose you were pushing on the system continuously. What should happen, according to Anderson's picture, is if you start at T equals zero and apply a pressure head, you'll accelerate the system. The velocity grows linearly in time. Then you reach this critical velocity, and then it should slip. It slips by a quantized amount. Then you accelerate some more, and it slips, accelerate some more. So it should be kind of oscillating in sort of a sawtooth way. And it turns out the frequencies given by the same formula of that Josephson frequency, and it has nothing at all to do with the Josephson effect. I don't even know, to be honest, after 15 years working on this topic, I don't know what people mean by the Josephson effect. So I'm sorry if I say it. It oscillates at the frequency that's the same as the frequency you'd get if you had a sine phi current phase relation. And that comes out generically because it has to do with 2 pi changes. It doesn't have anything to do with Josephson effects. We did an experiment at one point. It seemed to me if this was what was going on, there's an AC component on the flow velocity, so if you listened very carefully over here, you should hear the helium whistling with that frequency. And we did an experiment like that, found that there was no whistle. There was sound generated, but we realized that this is too simplified a picture. These vortices are nucleated by stochastic processes, and the fluctuations in the velocity where it occurs are so big that it takes away all the energy from the Fourier component right at that Josephson frequency. It's more like shot noise than a well-defined frequency. Anyhow, that's what phase slip oscillations would be if they occurred. Now, here's what happened to Emil. He took one of our generic cells, planning on using it in helium-3, tested it in helium-4, and let it warm up. And just below the lambda point, he kept repeating this experiment of pulling up on the diaphragm. Now everybody listens with headphones in my lab, by the way. He heard out of the headphones a little chirp. He said, "What was that?" And he went back in temperature and tried to control the temperature as well as he could. This is the kind of sound that he heard out of there. As Yogi Berra would say, it was deja vu all over again. This thing was undergoing some kind of Josephson oscillation. So what's going on in it? The first thing he wanted to do is say, was that frequency following the Josephson frequency formula? Well, unfortunately, the frequency, remember, is delta mu over Planck's constant. But for helium-4, there's two terms in there, a pressure term and an entropy term. And we can only measure pressure because there's no thermometer in here. However, the first instant that you pull it up, there is no delta T term. So you could make a graph of the instantaneous pressure right at the beginning and the frequency right at the beginning. They should follow the Josephson frequency relation, and it did. This is the frequency of that whistle as a function of that initial pressure head, and they followed the Josephson frequency. So then Emil did a beautiful job on analysis. He put a heater into the cell, and he found that by measuring the thermal properties of the cell, thermal relaxation, he was able to come up with a way that just by measuring the deflection of the diaphragm, he could tell instantaneously both what the pressure was and the temperature difference. So then what he tried to do is drive this oscillation thermally by putting power into this heater. Now, the way that this works is as follows. At time t equal to zero, start to apply power to the heater. The helium will start to warm up. So there'll be no pressure difference, but delta T will start to grow. And so chemical potential should grow, so the frequency should start to grow. On the other hand, there's an effect called the thermomechanical effect in superfluids, wherein superfluid always flows towards warmer regions. So what's supposed to happen is if the inside is warmer, there should be a DC superflow going through these weak links that slowly raises the pressure inside until the total chemical potential is zero. So if you turn on heat at T equals zero, this is what should happen. This line, the black line, is the term coming with delta T. You begin to heat it up, and it finally comes into equilibrium where the power you're putting in equals the power flowing out through the walls. The pressure starts at zero, and it starts to increase until the term delta P over rho is equal to the term S delta T, and then you get zero. The difference between the two terms is this line. It comes up, plateaus, and then goes down. That's what the Josephson frequency should do. So when Emil turned on the heater, this is the sound that he heard. I'm going to go over here. Whoops, wrong thing. Got to go back again. I'm not very good at PowerPoint. What do I want to do here? I want to, boom, boom. I want to click on this. So it went up, it plateaued, and then it went down again. I'll do that again just because it's such a nice sound. Maybe I'll do it. No, I won't do it again. Well, since he had a way of knowing instantaneously what P was and what delta T was, he could plot the frequency of that sound versus the full chemical potential, and again, it gave the full Josephson relationship. This is the first time that it was ever demonstrated that the thermal chemical potential term could play a role in the macroscopic quantum system. There should be terms like that in superconductors, but it's never been measured. Now the question we wanted to ask was, look, we know at low temperatures this system can't be a sine-like current phase relationship. That is to say that the healing length is too short. It might be a phase slip kind of thing. And at the highest temperatures, when the healing length gets bigger, it should be, eventually, a sine-like current phase relationship. The question was, how do you go from a current phase relationship, which is a straight line, which means current is proportional to velocity, which is proportional to phase difference, which is proportional... That was dumb. That's the kind of theory I like. Delta phi is proportional to delta phi. With no adjustable constants. What this meant, this should have been gradient of phi. All right, Vs is proportional to the gradient of phase, which is proportional to the difference in phase. This is the standard connection between current and phase difference for bulk superfluid. It's a straight line. But when the healing length gets big, the current should be proportional to the sine of the phase difference. How are you going to go from here to here? You might imagine something like this. This critical velocity depends on temperature. The higher you go in temperature, the lower it gets. So VC depends on temperature, but this drop does not. The drop is the quantum of circulation divided by the size of the hole. That's temperature independent. So you can see something's funny going to happen. If you start at low temperatures with this business going on and then you raise the temperature so VC comes down, at some point it'll look like this. This is still okay, but now it's like this. And now where do you go? The problem is conserving energy. Here you go from a velocity VC, V critical, and you slip and you get minus V critical. Since energy is quadratic in velocity, that's still okay. But suppose you make the temperature a little higher, this is going to drop down a little further, and you're going to go from one small velocity to a bigger velocity, and that's not going to happen, right? Because that won't conserve energy. So somehow in here, it's got to turn into the sine function. That was our intuition. Well, we have this technique of finding current phase relationships. I described it for you with helium-3. It's a little more complicated with the helium-4 because to get the phase as a function of time, you need to know the whole chemical potential, and that has two terms in it. But I told you, Emil Hoskinson found a way of getting both pressure and temperature. So in principle, we can get the current as a function of time from the time derivative of the motion of the diaphragm, and we can get, ultimately, phase as a function of time by integrating the chemical potential, get I of t, phi of t, and then remove the time to get the current phase relationship. So this is what we get. Again, we make a transient. We just pull on the diaphragm and then watch its motion in time. That's x of t. And then differentiate it to get the current and integrate it to get the phase. And what Emil has done here is made a composite of the data of all his current phase curves, and they're going to be played real fast, so it's like a video. The blue bar on the bottom is going to be the temperature difference away from the lambda point. The lambda point, again, is 2.17 Kelvin. That's the transition temperature. And so this is actual analysis. That's the current phase relation when we're down at somewhere around 32 millidegrees. That's where the healing length is short. And then the temperature is going to rise, and you'll see this morph from a straight line into a sine function, if this plays. Isn't that neat? See if I can do that again. I think that's a nice way to show the data. So by golly, this thing really does work like a Josephson weak link. When this flopped over when the blue bar was someplace over here, when you're about 5 or 6 millikelvin away, and that's about when it should start being sine-like. So what do we know? It's acting like helium-3 there. That is, it's all 4,000 apertures are Josephson oscillating coherently. And that might make sense to me, although I'm not sure why it should be true, but it is true experimentally. But now the question is, at lower temperatures, where it's a straight, where it was a straight current phase relation, in that regime, it's not a sine function going back and forth. There's a DC offset, and it's phase slipping. Why should that phase slip be coherent? And if so, why should it be coherent? Well, we want to understand, we know that from our measurements that just below where it stops being Josephson-like and starts being phase-slip-like, we know from the magnitude of the signal that all 4,000 apertures are coherent. And the question was, why? So the idea I liked, I was influenced by, there's a very beautiful book called Sync by Stephen Strogatz from Cornell University that talks about how nonlinear oscillators synchronize themselves in time. Fireflies do that, and crickets do that, and the neurons in your heart do it. Josephson junctions do it. RC oscillators do it. There's even a theorem that Strogatz proved that said any nonlinear oscillator that was concave downward to linear, if the interactions are right between the oscillators, synchronization is inevitable. So I thought maybe those 4,000 apertures are like quantum crickets. Maybe they start out of sync, but they interact with each other and eventually all become synchronized. I like that explanation. Also, I bought 4 copies of the book, one for everybody in my lab, so I wanted it to be true. On the other hand, maybe it comes about for reasons I don't understand, because the quantum phase on the two sides just has to be a constant. And when something happens, they're all locked together somehow, and I don't understand the dynamics, but this has to be the answer. So what we've done is we asked this question. If you pull up on that diaphragm and you hear that whistle, then they're synchronized. But, of course, thousands of cycles have gone by. So this is the end of that whistle, just before it starts to do this oscillation. By the way, this oscillation, I think I mentioned, that's this pendulum going back and forth. We call this a Helmholtz mode, and this is a Josephson oscillation. After thousands of oscillations, we can measure this amplitude. Let's go back and try and catch the very first phase slip and ask if that's the same size as after thousands and thousands of cycles. I wanted it to start out small and get big and lock in. By the way, it's the slope of this curve that gives you the current in the system. And you can see how this is different from a sine function. This is a sudden slip. You see how the slope goes from like this to like that? That's a sudden reversal in the current. So the experiment that my new student, Yuki Sato, did was as follows. He takes our little cell and pulls up on it suddenly, puts a little bit of potential energy into that diaphragm. And first he pulls up very gently, and all that happens is that the system just oscillates in this Helmholtz mode. This oscillation is coming from, to get a mode, you need a spring and inertia, right? So the spring is the restoring force in the diaphragm, and the inertia is the flow in the hole. So you give it a little gentle push, and it just rings. Then hit it harder, and the amplitude will be bigger. And hit it harder, and the amplitude will be bigger. At some point, you'll hit the critical velocity, and the system will make its first phase slip. That'll suck some energy out of it, and you can measure how much the velocity drop was. That's the very first phase slip. And then you go on and hit it harder and harder and harder. You can see the second phase slip and the third, and so on. So again, Yuki did this technique of taking all these data sets and piling them on top of each other and making a video out of it. So every curve here is one transient when you've pulled on the diaphragm with a certain force. And then each individual frame, you've increased the force a little bit. This one is kind of cute, by the way. I brought it along because I adjusted the critical velocity, so it's exactly equal to the facelift size. So when a facelift occurs, you suck all the energy out of the system. So you'll see that this amplitude of this oscillation will get bigger and bigger and bigger and suddenly just collapse. And then you'll see the facelift sort of move out. So we're increasing the size of that kick. Now watch carefully, and you'll see it collapse. Boom. And that's the first facelift sort of moving out. And then you'll see a second one and a third one and so on. I really get mesmerized I love the way the energy just all gets sucked out of the system. Here's one where you can see more facelifts and come out more clearly. So by taking the difference in slopes here, you can see how big the facelift is and ask, is the first one any different than at the end of a whistle when you've had thousands of them? Well, sad for me, they're exactly the same. The red dots are the size of the very first facelift, and the blue ones are the last of the facelifts after one of those whistles. So that says probably synchronicity, if that's a word, is not what's responsible for making all these things go together. We also looked at the critical velocity where they occur, and that's the same for the first slip or the nth slip. There's no difference. So I like to say maybe synchronicity plays no role. By saying synchronicity plays no role, leaving the maybe in, if you had oscillators that oscillated so strongly that the very first time one of them collapses, it locks up all the others, it still gets synchronized. But I have lost hope. And Amazon.com won't take back the three versions that nobody read. But now we've got a lot more questions. We don't understand this phase slippage process. What is it that's slipping? Do 4,000 apertures each get a little vortex that slips? Or does one start to go and then a giant vortex goes? Or does one slip and then by interaction cause like an avalanche and make them all go? We don't know the answer to those questions, and those are the questions that we'd like to answer. To help answer that, we've got this piece of data. We looked at the slip size as a function of temperature. Down here at about 6 or 7 millidegrees and to the left, it's the Josephson region. That's not phase slippage. To the right, it's phase slippage. And in fact, they start out from our measurements to be the magnitude of 4,000 all going together. But as we cool down, that begins to drop. We've now gone down to 160 millidegrees, and those triangles have dropped by 80% of their initial value. So somehow, whatever's going on in there, phase slippage starts out coherent, but gets less and less coherent as you go on. I hope I can solve that problem to understand why. Why does the phase slip size decrease as the temperature is lowered? We've got a bunch of ideas, but none of them fully explain everything. So the next step, and what I'll end with, is our next step is to build a gyroscope with this. This should give the same kind of physics as the helium-3 device, but it's more than just a parlor trick. The important thing here is this occurs at 2 Kelvin. Not only is 2 Kelvin 2,000 times higher than 1 millikelvin, but you can buy a commercial cryocooler that you can turn on a switch and get to 2 Kelvin. So if we can make a very sensitive gyroscope cooled with a commercial cryocooler, then it's conceivable that people like geodesists or seismologists or even, God forbid, submarine navigators could actually have an instrument. So our hope right now is we've just built the first prototype is 90% done, and Emil's going to be putting it into his cryostat, and I hope we'll know in the next few weeks if we succeeded. I'll just end. I've gone on too long, but I know you all wanted to stay. The things in blue here I didn't have time to talk about. What you should come away with is, I guess, two or three features. Helium 3-week links for temperatures not too far below the transition temperature act exactly like ideal Josephson weak links. In fact, all the physical effects that we've seen you can see more clearly in the superfluid state than in the superconducting state. And that's because instead of the frequency being up at terahertz, it's down where you can see them with a cheap oscilloscope. So we see Shapiro steps and Fisk steps and all sorts of things. So helium-3 weak links are a done deal. Helium-4 looks like near T lambda. All that same physics is going to be there. There's a sine phi current phase relation, and the Josephson equations will fully describe the system. The interesting physics part is that about this coherence. What in the world is going on? And I don't know the answers to it. And of course, the things that you don't know the answers to are the things that keep you going. You know there's an answer out there, and it's not going to be a complicated answer, but we've just got to find it. So thank you very much for your time. And I apologize for going over in time. Do you have clearance? other new kinds of gyroscopes are optical Sagnac gyroscopes and cold atom gyroscopes and this device. On paper, this looks like it'll be a lot better. That's on paper. But optical gyroscopes have had many years of development. The phase shifts made by rotation is 10 to the 10th times bigger when you have atoms than photons. But you have 100 years of technology behind measuring small phase shifts for optics. Cold atoms are a nice system, but you have two fundamental limitations. You've got shot noise. There's only a million or 10 million atoms at a time, so the fluctuations in those numbers end up as fluctuations in the currents, and that limits your signal to noise. In addition, you want a big area of this torus, And so far, there's no nice way of making atoms to go like that. You can split a beam a little bit, and to get a decent area, you basically go out for several meters and then bring them back again. The helium has Avogadro's number worth of atoms, so there's no shot noise, and it's real easy to plummet and make big areas. That's where I think the advantage will lie. But, you know, on paper, when you look at the theoretical numbers, they look phenomenal. It's better than anything in existence. But I've been an experimentalist not long enough to know that doesn't mean whatever. So we'll know in a few years if they're going to be better than the optical ones or not. Yes, sir. Well, the helium is supposed to be macroscopically coherent over, in some sense, an infinite length, which means what happens at one aperture should be communicated to all the others. And that doesn't matter how big it is, although the communication time, people debate whether it's the speed of sound or velocity of light. They talk about that. But they, over big distances, they should all be correlated together. I don't know. I mean, it's possible, but I don't know what the dynamics of the vortices are. I don't know how it's nucleated, where it's nucleated. Is it nucleated in one hole? And then as it begins to grow, it affects the others which nucleate it there? I just don't know. We're thinking a lot about that problem, but I don't know I can't answer your question. I wish I could. It's believed, and this is somewhat hand-waving, it's believed that the way a facelift dissipates energy is you have this organized potential flow coming through the aperture. Some of that energy goes into this quantum vortex that then is carried away from the system. You haven't lost any energy yet. And then somehow it quite, quote, collides with the wall and is broken up into smaller and smaller bits and pieces, eventually becoming the elementary excitations of the system. That's the description of how you go from this organized energy of low entropy to a higher entropy state. But who knows if that's true? I mean, it's not a solved problem. I don't think that you excite those modes. This is, you know, again, the hand-waving thing. Until you break things up, and it's not there's to excite phonon modes. I think you gotta whack it. It's like a bell, and I think these are gentle processes. That's what I think, but you know it doesn't matter what I think. I don't know the answer. It's the amplitude. It's the amplitude. So the size of the velocity motion, the size of the current, is 4,000 times bigger than what you would expect. And the reason I say that it's coherent is if you had 4,000 things all oscillating but not coherent, it would be the square root of 4,000 times more. If you have 4,000 violins playing the same note, the sound amplitude is bigger by the square root. So we can tell the difference between 65 times bigger and 4,000 times bigger. So that's how we know that they're coherent.
Have you checked, by the way, I mean, like, different number of holes? Have you tried
no.
500 holes?
No, I would love to do all these things, but using this one sample over the years has cost us $500,000. I mean, basically, one NSF grant times multiple years. These are real expensive experiments on the scale of NSF. So
when you say those proportional to N or what have you, why do you say that?
Only because the predicted critical current for one aperture was 1/4,000th essentially of what we got. So, and basically, I hope to never work on helium-3 again, because helium-4 is so cheap and fast compared to the helium-3. We've learned as much in 18 months as it took us 6 years in helium-3. To answer those questions in helium-3, I'll never be able to afford to do. In helium-4, though, we will be able to. We want to now go to an aperture that's 10 times bigger, 100 times bigger, and 1,000 times bigger, and see what goes on as you make it bigger. Well, we're only capable, we can't do things very close to TC in helium-4. The closest we can get is 50 nanokelvin, because to get very, very close, you need a different kind of apparatus, which we could make, but we're getting so much physics out of this one that Emil doesn't want to touch it. We can't see in this Josephson regime any kind of thermal fluctuations. And I suspect they're not going to appear even if we could go in closer. On the other hand, we get big thermal fluctuations with phase slip experiments where things are thermally activated.
So there's not any critical fluctuations that are...
Mm-mm. No. Yeah, but Gravity Probe B is coming out of a very deep pocket. That was $750 million. Yeah, sure, but that's not how you have different agencies with different size pockets. And the NSF pocket is very shallow indeed. In fact, it's sewn up right by the opening. So a big NSF grant for a single investigator, you can support 2 graduate students. That's it. So, you know, I had some some NASA money, but GW decided we're going to the Mars. So the entire fundamental physics program in NASA has been shut down. The decision is we're not going to do any science. We're going to give it to contractors in Houston and Austin and other places like that. So, you know, the science that has come out of this, there's like 5 papers in Nature, 1 in Science, 6 PRLs. That's going to be much more than comes out of Gravity Probe B for $750 million. But that's irrelevant. You know, it's politics. The public likes things going up into space, and they find helium very esoteric, even though it's cheap. That's life. Oh, we should stop. Thank you. Thanks a lot.